How do the leaders of organisations understand the lives of the people who work for them? Because a lot of jobs are designed as if people don't have a spouse, or as if the spouse doesn't have a career of their own. This isn't coming from me. It's coming from Jennifer Petrolieri, who's at INSEA, the business school south of Paris. And she says this really manifests in the tour of duty.
There's an idea that to reach the top, to reach senior leadership levels, I really need to have toured through a succession of roles in certain locations, in certain functions. So, for example, that might be a tour of duty in an emerging market, a tour of duty in head office, a tour of duty managing a country that's in some form of crisis or difficulty. So it's an idea that there are certain set tours of duty I need to do if I'm ambitious enough and if I want to reach those top leadership positions.
Right. So this idea has been around for some decades now.
Yes.
What is wrong with it?
Really, what's wrong with it at its root cause is the logic. So the logic of the tour of duty stems from two things. Organizationally, it stems from a time where there was no internet, there was no remote working, and everything needed to be done face-to-face. Now, of course, in that environment, a tour of duty is necessary. You know, how can I learn about an emerging market unless I go and have my boots on the ground? Now, that logic just doesn't hold anymore. We know that not only do we have all these technologies, but the way organizations work are very different. You know, organizations work in these cross-functional teams, in these global virtual teams. So it's simply not necessary to always be on the ground in another location. And in particular, it's not necessary to move there for, you know, 3 to 5 years, which is what these tours of duties are. Now, that's not to say it's never necessary, but it's not, you know, necessarily the best way to develop talent at all. At the same time, from a personal professional side, these tours of duties were really designed at a time when, let's be honest, most employees were men and most of them had stay-at-home wives. Now, even in those days, we know that the tour of duties often didn't work because the spouse was unhappy. But at least the spouse was, if we like a tag-along spouse, someone who was a homemaker who was following the breadwinner. That just isn't the case nowadays. In fact, the vast majority of professionals, the numbers vary a little bit by country, but we're looking at 60, 70% and rising year on year, are now in dual career couples. And so the ideas of these lockstep tours of duty where I spend 1 or 2 years here, then to the next place for 3 years, just simply doesn't work for the contemporary worker. So this logic neither works for the workers, nor does it necessarily work for the organization. And yet it seems something that is very hard for organizations to shake off.
As you say that, I'm thinking that's true. Increasingly, you find two clever, ambitious people are married. And if you're going to send one of them next year they have to go to India, then that kind of means that their partner has to go too, and their partner may not be able to get a similar role in India. So what is happening? Are people actually saying no to the tour of duty?
Yeah. So on the one hand, people are saying no and looking for careers that don't have this or other options. So in my research, many of the organizations I spoke to said, you know, it's just getting harder for us to find people who will do this. And as you say, what's happening in society, and there's a strange sociological term for it, which is assortative mating, which essentially means it's much more likely nowadays that we partner with somebody who's in our same kind of social and ambition class. So if we wind back 30 years, it's not unusual for somebody with a PhD, a doctorate, to marry somebody with a high school diploma. That almost never happens anymore. So what tends to happen is people marry within their very tight sort of socioeconomic band. And so very often, if we get these two highly talented people together, they may want to move, and then they will seek opportunities that suit them both, but they may not be in the organization they're working for. So what's interesting is it's not that these people are not mobile, but they're mobile on their own terms. They're no longer willing to just go where they're sent. And so these people are a lot more savvy in their couples about moving, but moving for opportunities that suit them both.
So there is a disconnect, though, between what the company is continuing to do and what the couples themselves want to do.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, there's a variance between organizations. Some companies are really starting to recognize this and, you know, see this as a big talent management issue. And other companies, quite frankly, are sleepwalking into a very restricted talent pool, talent pipeline pool. And so I think the companies, if you like, on the good end, are doing two things. One is they're revisiting the logic and saying, do we really need to send people continually on these lockstep rotations? Is that good for business? Never mind good for the people. And then they're also saying, when that is necessary, you know, what can we do to, you know, advance plan, work with the couple as a unit rather than the individual to make this work?
Is a company more likely to say, well, look, we need you next year to go to Kenya or to Canada or wherever it is, if that has been the culture that the boss has come up through?
Absolutely. And so what tends to happen, even though most of us would like not to admit this, is when we think about success, if we're successful people, we think, well, this is the way I did it. And that's the advice I'll give to other people. And so essentially, we try and push people into doing similar things that worked for us. And we do that in a very well-meaning way. You know, that's what's worked for us. And we think, you know, I want to help this person. So I'm going to try and, you know, mold them in my image. But of course, this just perpetuates the problem.
It's going to be increasingly hard to keep people. If you're not going to be flexible as the manager or perhaps as the entire organization, you're going to find that people will walk rather than go through it your way.
Absolutely. And what we're increasingly finding with, especially with the millennial generation, is they have slightly different goals and motivating factors than past generations. They're just not as willing as perhaps people in our generation to trade off the personal for the career. Now, that's not to say they're ambitious. That's not to say they don't want to get things done. But I think they have a lower bar for these trade-offs than perhaps other generations have had.
I want to ask you about something else that you've looked at, Jennifer. It's sort of connected. You've identified a problem of talent hoarders.
So this is a really interesting and unexpected finding of the research. So what happens nowadays in organizations, and of course, I'm talking about, you know, medium to large size organizations here, perhaps not so much in the small organizations, is talent talks. And they'll talk to each other about who are the good managers to work for. And when they talk about good managers, they're often talking about the managers who get it, you know, the managers who understand what it's like to be in these contemporary couples, to be ambitious and to have some constraints. And those talent will gravitate towards those people. And so those senior managers who sort of get it and can understand this issue and are attentive to it can really hoard talent in the organization. And I think this is very interesting because, you know, of course, the idea of the war for talent has been around for what, 20, almost 30 years now. But when people think about that, they think of the war for talent between organizations. Mm. What's happening increasingly is that war is within the organization. And the managers who can win that internal war for talent are the managers who really understand this issue and can work with it.
So this is about getting up to speed with your thinking. And something else you point out is actually a lot of companies, although they expect us to use the modern technology, they haven't realized that that means that we can be more flexible on our own terms.
What's interesting is this paradox of the technology. So on the one hand, the technology should allow us to work much more flexibly, remotely. You know, I can work from here with someone in China. But at the same time, what's actually happened is it's turned work into, as we all know, the 24/7 work culture. So it's actually harmed rather than helped our ability to work smart.
But I suppose you can use it to do all the non-work parts of your life. You can organize transport and groceries, and you can set up, I suppose, groups of other parents at the school and whom you virtually never see, but you can still stay in touch.
I mean, absolutely. And I think it would be just a Luddite who said, you know, technology is a bad thing. And that's absolutely not what I'm arguing. But what I'm arguing is that the way it's being harnessed by organizations right now is actually not good for productivity. What's happening is the culture of always being on actually makes us less efficient and less productive at our work than if we have those downtimes. And so it's not helping the individuals, but neither is it helping the businesses.
The commonality here is that the set of beliefs that underpin both getting people to go on a tour of duty and to always be on all the time because of the technology. They're both kind of grounded in the 80s, aren't they? Well, I think the tour is older, but certainly in the 80s, that was when we started to have this kind of fetishizing long hours. And if that's when people started, if that's when they came up, it's going to be hard to shift their thinking on this.
Absolutely, because if you think, if you came of age in the 80s, if that's when you started working, you're now the senior leaders in the organization. And so it's hard to shift that mindset. And I think what's really happened in the culture of work is a shift from quality to quantity. And although many people would say, no, that's not what's happening. If you look really at what's happening, is there's the, you know, the more the better, the more hours I'm online, the more dedicated I show I am. If I'm sending that email at 3 a.m, it's proof that, you know, I'm the most committed worker. And yet we know from centuries that this logic is a false logic. Increased quantity decreases quality. Actually, it doesn't increase quality. You know, we know this from production function studies in factories. We've known this for many, many centuries. And yet we're slipping back into this logic that more is better. And of course, we can see this playing out right now with the Elon Musk's saga in the US. You know, he's working 100 and whatever hours a week and the company is falling apart. Well, surprise, surprise.
So you're an educator as well as a researcher. Are we going to have to wait until the people you're educating now are actually at the top before we see a change?
I hope not. I do think that people in many, not all, but many organizations are starting to wake up to this and thinking, okay, we need to do something differently. But, you know, there's a distribution. There are still a good chunk of people, the people we've talked about who came into business in the 80s and who are now in those senior management positions, who are of the mindset, well, that's what I did, that's what they should do. That said, there are also people across the rest of the spectrum who've really understood these issues and are getting their people to work in different ways and, of course, are having the most productive units in the organization. So I'm hopeful that that message will spread across and people will start wising up to this. I'm also hopeful that the pressure, the sort of bottom-up pressure from that millennial generation will also force the issue a little bit more.
Jennifer Petrolieri is Assistant Professor of Organizational Behavior at INSEAD. And that's the show for this week. Best Practice is produced by Muruta Dias. Our sound engineer is Emrys Cronin. I'm Richard Adie.